When I got in, when I got the acceptance, it was like tears of joy. I was crying. Everything. I was like so happy, you know, that I got accepted. And the vehicles that they used to surveil and catch the original World Trade Center bombers, the very first bombing, they used our vehicles.
Do you think that because you kind of maybe know how to navigate that unspoken territory, that that's helped you with both opportunity, but also when you give advice to C-suite executives or doing any of that executive leadership training?
I mean, most people, they say, hate their jobs, right? And the majority, you always hear that, right? The majority of people hate what they do for a living, right? It's like, well, if you have the opportunity to take a chance, do what you want to do and succeed, I want to be there to help you out if you're a good person. If you're not a good person, screw you.
I'm Rachel Coble.
And I'm Liz Dean.
Welcome to Mock It. This podcast interviews industry experts from AI innovators to UX architects to nonprofit leaders and lots of people in between.
We explore the back of the napkin ideas that impact the nation so you don't have to dig for the discoveries yourself. Enjoy and don't forget to like and subscribe.
Hi, everyone. So this week, Liz is here. Don't worry. I know I look alone right now, but she's off on important MetroStar business. So I'm doing the intro by myself, but she's in this episode asking great questions as always. This week, we're really excited to have Gary White join Mock It. He's the founder and principal of Mapportunity, and he is a board member on lots of different boards, from nonprofits to artsy ones to sciencey ones. But most importantly, he's a board member at MetroStar. So we're very excited to have him on the episode. And if you like cats, this is definitely a great episode to listen to. So enjoy and don't forget to like and subscribe. We actually have a super important first question for you, because Liz and I have not stopped talking about it. Mm-hmm. Cowboy Kirby.
Tell us everything, and can they make an appearance?
Yeah. Does Cowboy Kirby live with you?
Oh my God. We're hoping that was the case.
You know what I'll do? This is the best I can do right now. I will crack the doors to my office here. And if he wanders in, you'll see him. He'll just hop on my lap.
Okay. Oh my gosh. Okay. So for the listeners who have no idea what we're talking about, on Gary's company website, we were going through the leader about page leaders. And at the very end, there's this cute little fur baby kitty cat called Cowboy Kirby. Did you write the bio for Kirby?
I didn't write the bio. He's the international cat of mystery. He should be on the website.
Bio is so good.
Thanks. He's my emotional support cat. I've got two cats, Kirby and Archie. Archie is the redhead, and Kirby is Instigator.
Justice
for Archie. Where is Archie?
Archie's a different beast altogether. Archie actually was a rescue. He has one hind leg that there's no bone. So like in the hip socket, you know, that he has no hip bone or socket joint that goes in.
This is an inspiring story. He should be on the website.
His leg is just attached by ligaments, and that's it.
Loosey-goosey to touch?
it's weird. Like you can like rotate it around, you know, type thing. Like, not that I do that for fun. I like, you gotta like rev him up to get him going or anything, you know, like an old airplane. But when he walks, it clicks out and like slides and then shuffles back in and then all that. So, but we love Archie, but he's one of those cats that hides like somewhere in the house for hours.
That's how all of my cats were growing up.
We call Kirby dog cat because he's like a dog. He calls or he comes when he's called. He's always at my heel. Like he is on me nonstop, like throughout the day.
That's my dream cat. I want a cat so bad, and Kirby sounds perfect.
You should just show up with a cat.
An appearance at some point. So
my husband's allergic to cats, but I kind of have this feeling like, oh, we just got married, so I'm going to give it like maybe another year, and then I'm just going to come home with one. Hello. He likes cats. He genuinely is kind of allergic.
Kylie Kelsey is going to do that to Jason Kelsey because she really wants a cat. And he's like, no. And she's like,
I love how you're talking about this like these are people you know.
That. Yeah, exactly. I've become very invested.
We're getting into the Kelseys. Is that what we're doing for this?
Okay. Well, we do talk about Taylor Swift almost every episode. So she's just going about it in a different route this time.
I should have done this in one of my daughter's bedrooms that has, you know, Swifty stuff like everywhere.
It would have been very fitting.
Did she go to the Eras tour this summer?
No, she's too young for that. This is my middle daughter.
You didn't want to spend $1,200 for your child to go to the
Eras
tour?
There was a dad who went and had a dad shirt that was a couple rows in front of us when we went, and it was great. It was like, he was invested.
How can you not be?
Listen. I didn't do that. I wouldn't spend the money on Taylor Swift that much money, but I did take her to Guns N' Roses at Hershey Park.
That's very cooler.
Yeah, we got a great picture of it too. We're both like full decked out, you know, Guns N' Roses gear. She's got the red bandana, you know, Axl style, like on, and you know, my 11-year-old just rocking it, and it was great.
I feel like you'd be a really cool dad.
I totally agree.
I mean, I have three daughters, and I just picked her up from school. It was on a Friday, and I just went to school. I picked her up like half an hour early, and we just drove, just the two of us, up to Hershey Park and just, you know, went to the concert. And
did you, like, so Ferris Bueller it, or did she know that she was getting picked up?
No, she knew. She wore her gear to school all day.
Oh, she was telling everyone at school. She's like, my dad's taking me.
Oh yeah, she was bragging. She's like, you know, GNR is like one of my favorites. She's this weird. I guess she's kind of like me. Like, she's got an eclectic music taste. You know.
So I love
everything
that.
From, you know, Taylor Swift to GNR to other stuff. Yeah,
that is so cool. And you're an artsy kind of person, aren't you?
Yeah, I guess I am. I guess I am.
You're involved in a lot of artsy nonprofits, right?
Yeah, I'm on the board of directors for the Workhouse Arts Center in Lorton, which is an old converted prison that is now an art. It's everything from an art studio to there's a part museum there that is a maintained portion of a cell block that was used to house the women suffragists when they were arrested in the 1920s outside the White House protesting. Cool. And so it's a museum. You can tour it and all of that. And then they have there's a theater. They just did Tommy or the Who's Tommy that received critical acclaim. It was a good event. And there's art studios throughout. So you can tour, you can take classes, you can hold events there. There's a lot of cool stuff. And there's a brewery and a coffee shop going in soon. So
that is so cool.
Pulling in more, you know, ways of people to connect and visit and enjoy the facility.
What got you involved with that?
Well, I guess the first thing is my neighbor, who's a friend of mine, she's the interim CEO right now. And they were looking to expand the board to get more veteran involvement because there's a veteran in the arts program there used for therapeutic art purposes. And, you know, they were looking to expand that just to be able to expand that offering and then other offerings to veterans and get sort of that community's insight into the programming and that kind of stuff. So that was sort of like the initial, but, you know, I mean, I grew up in this area, so I remember the old, when it was a prison, like actually a prison, and, you know, and then, you know, seeing it converted over the years when I came back after my time in the Air Force and then retired at the Pentagon here, you know, I saw it change and it's right down the street for me. And yeah, like you said, I'm an artsy guy and I wanted to get more involved in that community and give back into the lives of people from a non-military, you know, traditional military perspective.
That's what I love about it. I feel like one thing I really love about my own dad is he is an engineer. So he's got that very sciencey brain. He's a chemical engineer, but he loves the arts. He likes going to play. I was a ballerina. He went to all of my things. Like, he's really into the arts. When my mom was giving birth to me, he was in an art class sculpting like wood or something along the lines. And she called and was like, I need my husband. But so I love when people with sciencey jobs or tech jobs or STEM jobs have this artsy side. I think that's so cool. So I love, have you always been artsy?
Oh yeah. When I was a kid, you know, my dream job, I wanted to be a cartoonist.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I was, you know, art classes out the wazoo. I had my portfolio, like all that stuff. And but things didn't quite work out because of certain things in my childhood. But yeah, so I never ended up going down that path career-wise. But, you know, it's always been a part of me.
I see the guitars and maybe a drum set in the background behind you.
So you're music talented too.
Yeah, my acoustic and electric, and then I get some art up.
Did you do that? Those arts?
No, God.
No. I was gonna be like, wow.
Wait, let me take that back. Yes. I
did. What was your favorite cartoon growing up?
You know, it's funny. Comic strip wise, it was Garfield by far, and I think it's because I think I relate. You know, I'm that Monday. Like, you know, I hate Mondays. I love lasagna, which is why I married an Italian woman. And I just want to lay around with Cowboy Kirby all day.
Oh, why didn't you name Kirby Garfield? Because he's not orange, I guess.
You know, we could have named Archie Garfield, but you know, we like the Archie.
Or you like Archie comics?
Yeah, Archie comics were okay. I mean, I read them all. I watched the cartoon. You know, it's funny, when my kids were real, when they were babies, we used to sing Sugar Sugar by the Archies too. And we put them to bed at night and get addicted to that for a while. That was actually the number one. So during Vietnam, I don't know if you know this, during Vietnam, Sugar Sugar was number one on the charts for something crazy, like 2 months straight.
Whoa. So people were like just trying to feel good.
Yeah. It was just this weird juxtaposition, right? Of like being at war. A very unpopular war, and then you got these people out there like listening to the radio, and they're listening to a cartoon saying Sugar Sugar. Like, it's such a weird
that's my favorite kind of era to look into, though, because of all of those weird juxtapositions.
Okay, so now we've learned some of your like artsy side. You also are a founder and a principal of a company, Opportunity. Do you want to give us the rundown of the journey that led you to establish Mapportunity and a little background on what Mapportunity is?
Sure. So Mapportunity is, it's my playground, really. That's what it is, right? It's so I guess I'll give a little background there. So my career started out, I co-ran my family business, which was called the Van Stand. And we did van and truck conversions for the federal government and private clients. So, you know, like DOD, FBI, we did their surveillance vehicles.
Wow.
Definitely some cool claims to fame there. So like the vehicles that they used to surveil and catch the original World Trade Center bombers, the very first bombing, well before 9/11. And then the Olympics in Atlanta, when there was bomb activity there, they used our vehicles. So it was, you know, definitely... Wow. Had some cool stuff come out of that, and stuff for local SWAT teams, which is why, like, as a teenager, I'd get to go shooting, you know, with the Fairfax County SWAT team on their private range and things like that.
I bet that made you feel real cool.
It made me feel nervous. It made me feel nervous because, you know, I was always breaking the law at that age. And so then I'd be around all these police officers and I was freaking out, you know, as a 17-year-old, you know, when I first started working at my dad's shop. Yeah, doing that kind of stuff. It was interesting. But so I started out there, did that for many years. And then when I graduated college, I went into the Air Force and I served there, retired out of the Air Force, and then I went to GSA. Where I stood up their innovation arm in terms of innovation contracting with small businesses, you know, advanced technology, things like that. And I retired from there 7 months ago-ish, and I formed Mapportunity as a way to stay connected in that community, work with, you know, small businesses, startups, those that are trying to, you know, get into the federal space and could use the extra help. And then I also wanted to... I wanted to like partially retire. So I wanted an avenue to keep things flexible so I could scale it in whatever way I wanted, when I wanted, if I wanted, and in areas outside of that as well. Right. So like if I wanted to do more stuff in the art realm, if I wanted to do more stuff, you know, in the nonprofit realm, I would, you know, think about, you know, ways I could partner there as a for-profit myself, but, you know, partner with these entities. And I've been doing that. I've been doing a little bit of everything, and that's it. But the bread and butter of Mapportunity is doing just that, mapping out opportunities for small businesses to grow, whether that's federal or private capital.
Oh, that is cool. Liz and I were just talking before the podcast that owning our own business is both of our nightmares. But you made it sound fun.
Well, because I feel like the finance part is just like the scariest part, because you're putting a lot out into the universe and hoping it comes back and, you know, you'll be able to support your family. So you kind of help people bridge that gap. So that's why I was like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I have a love for small businesses. You know, I think that there's this old cliche that, you know, the greatest threat to national security is the economy. Right. I believe that. I believe that, you know, small businesses are the backbone of society at large, you know, and in the whole American dream context, I think that, you know, they're an extremely important piece of that in living, you know, your dream, your life as you want to live it, you know, being able to have the freedom to do what you want to do. I mean, most people, they say, hate their jobs, right? I mean, majority, you always hear that, right? Majority of people hate what they do for a living, right? It's like, well, if you have the opportunity to take a chance and do what you want to do and succeed, I want to be there to help you out if you're a good person. If you're not a good person, screw you.
So did you always know that you wanted to start your own small business, because you grew up in an entrepreneurship family? So entrepreneurial family.
Same words. <son.
laughs> Yeah, I did. And I have before, actually, too. So this isn't my first rodeo. I started a couple things over the years. One was interesting. I created this tech. It didn't go very far. I mean, we were still in the initial stages, but a partner of mine and I, we created this tech company that provided audio running tours when that was at its peak, you know. And it was like, so you're a traveler going to a new city and, you know, you don't want to use the hotel gym. You want to get out, explore, you know, the area and find out, you know, fun facts, but you also want to get your run in or walk or whatever you're doing, you know, out there, fitness stations, whatever it may be. And so we created an app that did that. And I'll say it on the podcast, you know, Marriott stole it from me. I pitched it to Marriott and Under Armour, even through their small business channels for disabled veterans. And they said, we're not interested. And then 6 months later, they launched it. And even my tagline and everything. And they partnered with Under Armour, which I pitched them separately. And then, you know, part of the thing was, I was like, oh, you guys should team up. And then this will be the whole solution. So I've been doing entrepreneurial stuff for a while, whether it succeeded or not, you know.
Did you sue? That's insane. Well,
you know, it's funny thing is, I didn't realize that they did it until
it was too late.
It was at least like 4 or 5 years later.
Oh,
I found it and I was like, holy shit, this is my, like, this is my idea. Oh. And so I said to my partner, I was like, do you think it's just coincidence? Like, it's me. He's like, no, that's definitely, it's the tagline, like everything, you know, it's the whole deal.
Yeah.
And so I talked to an IP lawyer and he basically said, unless I have, you know, hundreds of thousands to spend fighting this giant corporate entity, you know, there'd be really no way unless we went like the social media route with the whole disabled veteran thing and, you know, try to essentially, you know, shame them into admitting and then, you know, whatever. And it was like, you know what, I got two
you're a good person
going on. I don't want to deal with that. It's okay.
So, oh, that
so
would
be aware. Any of you five people listening to me talk, beware of these giant corporate companies.
Oh man, that's so scary. I've also heard that a lot of people, this is on a much smaller scale, but when you're interviewing for a job, if they make you do like a project or like give them ideas for like a marketing campaign or something like that, it's like, be very wary because they could not hire you and then take that idea and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
So it's NDAs, just a scary world.
I'm telling you. It is. I mean, it's unfortunate that you can't trust people to, you know, I mean, you can trust people, but sometimes, you know, you just have to be extra cautious when it comes to business dealings.
Yeah. When you were looking at doing Mapportunity, what kind of research went into that to make sure you weren't taking another idea or to make sure that it was something that was really needed in the industry or environment?
Well, you know, Mapportunity is in a place that is, I would say it's a growing field right now. And so when I was at GSA, all of a sudden, I would say, and I was there for 5 years, in our probably second year to third year is when I started to see companies kind of like what I'm doing step in and we'd never seen them before. They were sort of intermediaries between startup businesses and the federal government, not just like a traditional consultant, but they were doing everything involving applying for and winning, in particular, SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research type grants, contracts, things like that. And they just became more and more prevalent. I think that's because that type of program is like decades old, but it's had a rejuvenation in the last, 10 years. And I think that they saw that there's money in that. And so they started to get into that space. Where I differ, though, is, on a few fronts I differ, but on the financial business model of it is they actually draft like these proposals that are in multi-phases, and they charge win rates. So they're quite expensive, a lot of them. They'll charge people anywhere from, $3,000 to $10,000 a month on retainer for like 6 months. And then they'll charge up to 10% win rate on whatever dollars the government puts on contract. So, you could get, millions of dollars out of doing something like that. Me personally, I mean, look, there's nothing against those people. I work with some of them, and that's their model, and that's great, for them. For me, my take is you're better off if you really want to make an impact on the small business and you really want to establish a long-term relationship, let those win fees, instead of going to you, let them go back to the company, because essentially that cuts into their profit margin. So they can use that to build themselves as a company, to scale, grow bigger, use it to, if they owed you $150,000, let's say, win fee, that just goes into your pocket, whereas the company could hire another body to further their work, right? So I don't do that.
So you've been in military, small business, government, a lot of different sectors. Do you see any other trends in innovation besides the win costs?
Trends in innovation. I mean, there's a tons of tech trends in innovation right now, right?
AI.
All that kind of stuff. Yeah, I think the biggest thing to look out for is anything that's going to make work and logistics pipelines more efficient. I think that's really like it. Bottom line, whatever type of technology doesn't really matter in the end, because that's always going to change and progress. But it's any type of efficiency, because ultimately the efficiencies result in cost savings, and those cost savings can go towards scaling or building out a new capability or whatever. Right? That's what everybody's always looking for. So at scale. And so, again, I think it's anything that can be focused in that realm. Anything like new tech, that kind of stuff, you have to start at the basic research level. And that takes decades sometimes to get to a point where you can like build something that people are going to buy in mass, right? So I think that's a little bit harder to target. But, once we're talking at like the point of commercialization, it's, anything that in those areas are going to make businesses more efficient and effective. And in the military realm, in terms of innovation, it's making it more lethal, right?
Oh my gosh, capacity. That kind of terrifies me.
Well, even if that's a means to just deter, because others are afraid of the lethality of the capability, right? Let's get back to art.
Let's talk about Kirby more.
Now we call it Kirby.
Which is hard for Liz and I, because obviously we work at MetroStar. MetroStar does do a bunch of defense things.
And I'm on a military contract.
You're on a military contract, like working on these missions and like doing these innovative things for those types of situations. But I feel like Liz and I are like, it's okay.
But that's okay. We need that, right? You need any organization. You need a balance of people and perspective. And all of that. It's kind of funny. I was just having a conversation with my wife this morning about it. I've said this over and over again. So you've got like actively right now, people that serve as less than 1% of the population of the U.S.
Wow,
right?
Really?
That seems so low.
It's accurate. That's what it is. And so you have less than 1% actively serving, and you have less than 10%. And that's just dropping, of course. Almost all the World War II veterans are gone. Oh. Vietnam veterans are, dwindling out at this point as well. It's just going to reduce, right, over time. here. So you have less than 10% of the entire population has ever worn a uniform, right, and served.
Wow.
And so a lot of people, you know, just don't, you know, we're in a highly concentrated area here in the D.C.
Yeah. That might be why I'm so shocked, because I see people in uniform all the time living in the D.C. area.
Yeah, and at MetroStar, we have more than 10% of vets
at MetroStar.
So that's crazy.
Sure. But yeah, and that's common in this area, right? Because the density. But, you know, a lot of places, I mean, obviously, you know, 99% of the United States.
The world is big.
population, yeah, it does, has never touched it directly, you know, themselves. And so it's, I mean, at least from a service member's perspective, right? I mean, numbers are big, are higher when you count like civilians in, but it's still not that big. It's still in the single digits. But, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon. So when you talk about things like understanding of, you know, what's going on out there in the military and like really getting it, really understanding the process and, you know, all the things that go into decisions that are made and, you know, purchase of weapon systems, acquisition, you know, contracts and things like that. I mean, most people just don't understand it. I mean, there's a lot of ignorance, whether that's, you know, self-inflicted or not. You know, a lot of the population, honestly, they just don't care, right? Because it doesn't affect their day-to-day lives. You know, they don't yeah. touch on it. It's interesting. They live in a whole other world than a lot of us that have just been in it a long time. It feels like second nature. But when I think back to like when I joined, I didn't know. I mean, I knew like my family history, you know, they'd serve, but like I knew from that perspective, but I didn't know shit myself, right? Until I went in. Experienced it. So
I love that you brought up your family. You're every single one of your generations of your family served, correct?
Yep. Back to the Revolutionary War. And yeah, so every generation served. My dad was in the Marines, my grandparents all one was Navy, three were Army, two of them were in OSS, which was the predecessor to the CIA and Special Forces. Oh, that's cool. And one of them went off to join. He just stayed with them, and he was a founding member of the CIA, and then retired after 30 years there.
You brushed over that so fast.
And he just goes on and on and on. I mean, I've got like all their stuff. And my great grandfather's World War One Victory Medal, you know, and five battle clasps on it, which is, you know, he was just back to back battles. His unit was in the most battles of any unit in World War One. And, you know, so we just got, you know, this history of service.
And,
you know, so in that regard, the Whites and all the other names of my family, you know, over the years, we've done our part.
Did you always know you were going to join then? Did you feel like this innate call to do it? What made you decide to do it? To join?
9/11.
I feel like that's a common. Yeah. Were you one of those that was literally right after that you decided?
I was right after, but there was such a backlog. I wanted to go. I didn't want to enlist. I wanted, because I had just graduated college a year or so prior, and I just wanted to. I wanted to go in as an officer, and so there was a backlog. I mean, at that point, the Air Force was only taking, so I went through officer training school, which is there's different types of accessions into the service. And at the time, at least they told me, the Air Force was taking 14% of applicants.
It was really low.
And so I had to wait after I put my package in, I waited something crazy, like 6+ months before I found out. And then there was almost a year wait after that.
What was that waiting like? Was it nerve wracking? Where could any day you just
could you train during that time?
What were those 6 months like?
Well, waiting to find out. Yeah, that was nerve wracking because I wasn't happy what I was doing. I wanted to go serve. I wanted, you know, it's also good timing for me too, in terms of like life change. So, yeah, I mean, it was when I got the acceptance, I mean, I drove out to my dad's shop and, you know, I had a like out from the car, I'm flashing it and I broke down. It was like tears of joy. And I was crying and everything. I was like so happy, you know, that I got accepted and was starting on this new career path and getting to go serve, you know, in a time of war and all of that. So.
Why Air Force? Because it sounds like you have family members and other kind of sections too. Like, what made you choose Air Force? You just want to fly planes?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, I went, I, I almost went Army. I went into recruiting. Mm-hmm. It's like a lot of people have stories like this. You know, I went in the recruiting office, you know, they're all there. You know? And I walked past the Marine one, you know, and I was like, I don't know. My dad did that. Maybe I don't want to do that. And I went to the Army one, and they were all over me and, you know, took a test and all this in there. And the guys are like, you want to jump out of airplanes and blow shit up? And I'm like, yeah, that sounds awesome. You know, I'm young.
That's also right, nightmare.
And they tried it. They're like, oh, you'll go special forces. We can put you in that track and you'll go as an E5, you know, which is up a few rungs because I had a college degree and all this stuff. And I'm like, you know, they're trying to sell me. I'm like, you get these special, like, you'll get some cool Oakley sunglasses. And oh, no. I'm like, I already have Oakleys. Like, why do I need, you know? And it sounded cool, but then something, I was like, you know what? Let me go talk to my dad and then I'll be back. And, you know, of course they're trying to get me to sign like every step out. And so as a timeout, I go out to a shop and my grandfather, my dad's dad, he was in the Army Air Corps. He was a navigator and, which is where the Air Force came from. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, my dad's like, no, you don't want to go Army, like go Air Force, fly, you know, and he tried to tell me all these benefits about being in the Air Force, treat their people better, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, flying. I never even thought about flying, honestly. I was like, oh my God, it'd be great. I can fly fighters, like all this cool stuff and everything. And I said, yeah, let's do it. And so he hooked me up with some friends of his that were some retired generals. And they wrote me some nice letters of recommendation. And, you know, I had to go through the whole interview process and all that. And the rest is history. Funny thing is, then I got into the Air Force. And by the way, at that point in my life, I'd only ever flown on an airplane once.
My gosh.
Like, I was in my early, I joined the Air Force a little late. I was 25 when I went in, and I'd only been on an airplane once in my life, like ever.
Talk about trial.
Was it like a long flight too, or was it like a super short regional flight?
Yeah, it was pretty short. I mean, it was from Boston to here.
You know? Oh my gosh, that's like an hour flight.
Yeah, I know. It was like an hour and a half flight, right? I'm like, that's my flying experience. And it was years ago at that point. It was like 10 years, you know, prior. And I'm like, yeah, you know, so I had all these like visions of it and everything. So I get into the Air Force. I went in as what's called an air battle manager, which, you know, the recruiters, they all try to lie to you, right? So they're like, it's like a navigator, but cooler. And I'm like, oh, okay. And this is like the internet's not rampant, you know, like there was no real way, there was nothing to look it up.
No Reddit threads to scroll through.
Right. So I'm like, okay. So anyway, I get through it. I get to training and everything. And I realize, holy shit, like I'm sitting at a screen controlling aircraft on an aircraft. That's what I'm doing. Right. I have like a chunk of airspace and it's like the opposite of an air traffic controller. You're putting, you know, planes on target, you know, you're doing, you know, aerial refueling, you're controlling all of that. So like, essentially you have a chunk of space and other people next to you do as well. And everything that goes on in that assigned chunk is your responsibility. So you have to learn how to control aircraft in a dogfight, non-dogfight scenarios, and all sorts of different things.
So, I feel like I'm watching Top Gun, just having you talk about this.
Not stressful at all. Definitely
not that cool. There were very few volleyball scenes.
Oh man. Similar reason I never want to join the Air Force.
Yeah. So anyway, we go through all this, you learn how to do it on the ground first, right? So you control aircraft to get through that portion. And then you go to flight upgrade and we're on AWACS, which is like a giant modified airliner, but there's no windows and it's old as shit. And you know, it's just, it's got that giant radome on top of your Yeah, that thing's huge, by the way. It's 6 feet tall in the middle. So you can stand up if you're 6 feet, like you won't hit your head. It's that big.
That's crazy.
Like you won't realize. Yeah. Anyway, get on there. You know, you do your flights and I'm puking every time. I can't take it. I'm getting air sick. And, you know, I do a deployment. I did counter drug operations in South America. I came back from that deployment, spent a little more time. And I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to fly. I'm an Air Force guy who thought I could go in the flying field and I couldn't stop puking.
Oh no.
Yeah. So I transitioned out and I got into drones and SATCOM type stuff. Oh. And then I got into acquisition, but like not traditional because they're like, you're an ops guy. We don't know what to do with you. So I did a bunch of weird, wacky things in that world. And
that's cool you were in drones, though, because you're probably maybe at the forefront of that. Because now everyone knows what a drone is. But when you got into drones, were they as mainstream as they are now?
So at the time that I got into that, there's a service called GBS, the Global Broadcast Service. And it's a satellite constellation that, it's based on a satellite constellation, the services that supplies what's called full motion video. So think about it like DirecTV, you know, or satellite TV, we'll just say, for feeds coming from mostly at that time, Predator drones. So, at the height of the Obama administration, use of drones, so like 08 to 10, I was in charge of the operations chief of the entire
network. I think that's when I first started hearing about drones. It was the Obama administration.
Yeah, so that entire network of video and still photos that went through the pipes, basically from those drones down to units, you know, on the ground in the field and on ships and stateside and whatnot. So, you know, we had them. The service was positioned all over the world. So it was in the theaters, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, Korea, and then, you know, in North America and South America for some operations down there. And so anything that went on through a drone, through that system, that was my system that was responsible for making sure that it operated and maintained. And so we had three sites. I had three sites globally of people. Wow. And that was a big one. So yeah, it was a lot of stress for a very, at the time I was a captain. I wasn't, you know, high ranking or anything. It was a lot of responsibility. It was probably in over my head. And yeah, it was a learning experience, that was for sure.
I mean, that sounds like a big learning experience. How was your transition out of the military like? Was it nerve-wracking? Did you know what you wanted to do after?
I mean, not to get too much into it, but my transition out, so I went back and forth between active reserve, you know, back and, you know, type thing. And I was against my will. I was medically retired out at 17 years. So
That doesn't sound fun or great.
It is what it is. So I did not want to, but the policy that year by SecDef was, if you can't deploy, you know, at any point in the next year, you're out. So the medical staff, there was no way around that. So I went through the process begrudgingly. And I was treated very poorly through the private life. I mean, we could do a whole nother show just on that alone. You know, a lot of issues with that, you know, where you feel like you've given everything. And, you know, I was the type to always volunteer, say, yeah, I was just a good airman. And I really felt like they were turning their back on me.
And that
was a real hard pill to swallow. I have since made some, you know, reconciliation in my mind over it. But yeah. To a great extent, yeah, there's still a lot of negative,
feelings towards that. Yeah.
Right. What I find very discouraging hearing that, and then also with working with military personnel and retired military personnel, I don't think your story is unique in a lot of ways in terms of how you felt, you know, you're the exit process. And so, yeah, it's, I'm sorry you had to go through that. I'm sorry that's such a common,
prevalent thing.
Yeah.
No, I appreciate that. Yeah. No, and you're right. It's not uncommon. There are a lot of people with, you know, worse stories than mine. There are a lot of people, you know, with stories that aren't as bad as mine in some ways. Right. But everybody has. Yeah. It's life. You go through things, but, you know, in terms of the military, like, it's an interesting thing. Yeah. I mean, some stuff they're very good at and other things they just don't put in the time, and you truly are a number, right? In the end. So you have to figure out personally what service means to you and, you know, how you're going to handle the good stuff and the bad stuff that comes with that. And, you know, your interpretation of what I would say is a contract that you sign with the government for your service, you know, versus stuff that's like an unspoken contract.
That's a stressful part. I feel like there's a lot of unspoken things that happens when you join the military.
Do you think that because you kind of maybe know how to navigate that unspoken territory, that that's helped you with both Mapportunity, but also when you give advice to C-suite executives or doing any of that executive leadership training?
Yeah, you know, my big takeaway, I mean, it's a loaded question, right? That's a deep
softball
one.
Questions are over now. No more Kirby talk.
Here we go. Oh, wait, my signal's breaking up. I've always been this way, but I think after that experience, it just became more reinforced to take care of your people, right? Like everybody's got issues, you know, and things going on in their life. And if, you know, employees of yours, you know, I understand some people don't want to share everything and that's okay, but you should make it so that your door really is always open to you. You know, for people to access you and relate anything personal that they may want to relate to you, you know, and it doesn't mean you necessarily have to get into that with them, but you should at least understand what resources are available to take care of your people, have an open ear and respect them, you know, as humans. And in particular in the military and in this world, this national security world, I mean, it's serious stuff that we do. And, you know, a lot of it weighs on you. I mean, you don't always even necessarily have to be in a combat scenario yourself, but just the stress of the job and doing it for years and years and always hearing, you know, national security and terrorism and threats and, you know, destruction and, you know, just, you know, bad thing, bad people. Like, we gotta fight the bad
I'm stressed
guy.
About you it. Know? I'm not even in the military.
It's not exactly a super positive environment.
Yeah.
And that does weigh on people. And then you throw in all the personal stuff going on in people's lives. And, you know, you just need to be as a leader. You need to be on a personal level with people to really be effective, I think. And,
I love that.
Understand that these are humans doing a job for you and for the country, if that's what they're doing, you know, and that's fine. But again, it's a human with a lot of
complex,
you know, interesting aspects.
Diverse yeah. emotions.
Yeah,
I love that you said that, because I'm one of those people that likes to overshare with my bosses. Like, you probably didn't need to know that, actually.
I feel like I'm like that, too. And like, so the PMs and the bosses on my project are all military or retired military or ex-military.
Mine are fun little girlies, so can't relate.
But I think they try to have that, like, that perspective that you were saying, that, you know, like, they're so calm when stuff happens that, you know, on, like,
they've seen worse.
Yeah, like, on the personal side, you know, they're so calm on things and they're so, like, understanding. I'm like, probably because, as you said, you see a lot worse than, you know, can't, you know, need to work from home today. Or, you know, like, I don't mean to belittle that, but
yeah,
in comparison.
They're like, your kid is sick, you can go home. I've seen worse.
Yeah. I mean, it can build a certain perspective. Yeah.
I love that. I know we're coming up on time. You have meetings that are coming up, but I need to just bring up one more question. It's not about Kirby, although I wish it was.
And I'm disappointed he hasn't made an appearance.
I know. Can you make the little cat noise? Wait, what is it? The come here, Kirby. Okay, Craig, maybe cut that out.
The best podcast.
I'll play back that bit later.
Yeah. Just send me a video of Kirby at some point.
It's gonna
today.
Be the new ringtone to call Kirby.
Oh no, yeah.
I'll bring him into the MetroStar office sometime.
Please, just please ping me. Let me know that he's
we'll
coming.
Let facilities know. It'll be cool.
I just right. moved. Right. My commute is horrible, but I will take that commute for Kirby. I will. Okay, my last question, and it's kind of not completely off track of what we've been talking about, but we're really deep into the MetroStar Innovation Lab right now, and you have had a lot of experience over at the Harvard Innovation Lab.
So cool.
And so I know it's like, that's like a big buzzy university to have on your resume, so congratulations. I think this is almost more of a personal question, because we've been working a lot on the MetroStar Innovation Lab and talking about it and all of those things. So really, I guess this is for me and not our listeners, but what is your advice for companies who have Innovation Lab that you've taken from the Harvard Innovation Lab on how to make your innovation lab stand out or to actually make an impact? Because I mean, everyone has innovation labs now. Like, how do you actually not just have fluff on your page and make it impactful?
Great question.
Thank you, Alyssa.
Boy, that's a loaded one. I mean, you could literally, I know I said this once jokingly, but you could literally do a whole show on that. You know,
oh, well, we can. You can come back. Yeah, but you have to bring Kirby.
Well, then I could pitch you my steamy lab. You know? Ooh. So you're talking about STEM earlier. So I call it steamy, which is, you know, science, tech, engineering, art, math, and inclusive innovation.
I love that.
So on the little I at the end.
Oh, I'm going to start calling it steamy.
Anyways, well, the Harvard iLab is one type of innovation lab, right? I mean, it is catered towards the student and alumni community, and trying to help them essentially scale and launch startups, right? Companies based on whatever ideas they have. We just did, there's a giant President's Innovation Challenge that goes on every, it's like the big event of the year. That happens right before graduation in May. And we just finished the second to last, so semifinal round of reviews that I was judging on. And it's interesting to see, like, the, you know, the ideas that a lot of these students and alumni around the world, you know, because a lot of people come to Harvard and then they leave and then they go back to their country, you know, they came from. It's not like a traditional university in some ways, you know, yeah. People from everywhere. It's just interesting to see their concepts and, you know, help them, you know, get to the point where they can scale their company, like make it a real company and then scale it. So that's like one model. And then you have like other ones I participate in are like, you know, Space Force, Air Force. They all have accelerator programs. The Army has accelerator programs. Some of them are aimed towards, you know, like startup studio style, which is like you know, a lot of corporations do that where you have an IP, right? Intellectual property around something. And then you decide we want to make something of this other than just licensing it out to other businesses. Let's build a separate company around that IP and let's build that company from within our company and just launch it and scale it as a subsidiary. Right. And so, you know, there's some that do that, like the Army has some programs like that. They also have programs that they fund that are more like accelerator incubator, sort of like, you know, those programs are like a condensed business school, right? It's like an executive education for like 4 months, right? Like things to do to make your startup successful. And then at the end, they always culminate like a pitch day in front of investors, you know, to try to get money, you know, for your startup.
And hopefully they don't steal your idea.
But yeah, you know, so there's different types of programs and things like that. I think for a company like MetroStar, you know, and a lot of other of these, you know, federal contract focused, you know, integrator type companies, I think really the key is finding IP, intellectual property, whether you do it in-house or buy it from somebody else. And then finding ways to either incorporate that into larger solutions that you present to the government in order to win larger contracts or like more scalable, you know, wider reaching contract capabilities, or build like startup studio style, build another subsidiary around it, and then to hit another vertical within the federal space, you know, that also can touch the private sector space as well. I think that's a big piece of it. A lot of people talk about like dual use tech these days and how that, you know, gets investment from both sides of the house and everything. But I think it also, what they don't really talk about is the resiliency of that approach, right? And so it's not just like thinking about defense money in and then private, you know, venture capital or whatever, private capital equity, you know, coming in to pair against that. You got to think about like, building something, an IP, and then whether that's a licensure again or, you know, spin-off company, that technology applies to the defense space, but also applies to the energy department or applies to the transportation department. Something that is scalable within the department or within the federal government itself to, again, make the solution and the investment you put into it initially resilient against, you know, going down in accessibility and funding availability. So
always down to funding.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, you know, money
it really makes is. Yeah. I hate to say it, but it is.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, so, you know, if you boiled it all down, it's long-winded, sort of convoluted way to say, in these types of lab environments, I think, you know, it should be focused on R&D, whether you buy it or do it in-house. That's a business decision based on finances, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other piece of that is you should be, ultimately, your goal is commercializing that thing that you're investing in some way. And really, I think it's those two paths. It's either you're going to quickly, you have to figure out a way to just license this thing out to start making money off of it, and or look at spinning this off into it's either just an own business unit or a business itself, and then providing that as, you know, another offering. That's kind of it for a company like MetroStar.
Nice. Well, thank you.
So, yeah, great perspective.
Nice. So this
take
was
it for what it's worth.
I loved it. It was insightful. thank you so much for joining us today. We had such a good time. I feel like we could talk to you for hours about all the things you've done in your life, your cats, like, et cetera. We'll definitely want to have you back on, not just to see Kirby, but to talk to you a little bit more. But thank you so much. This has been such a good time.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, nice to meet you, Liz. And thanks. We'll talk again.
Yeah, we will. Bye.
Bye.